And we can get a long way to go with energy efficiency. For example, HVAC systems are typically about 40% of the energy use of a commercial real estate building. And 30 or 40% of the energy being used by the HVAC system is typically wasted.
Colliers' ESG initiative, called Elevate the Built Environment, is designed to embed environment, social, and governance best practices across the organization. My guest, Sean Dreigas, is leading this effort as the global lead ESG and impact. In this podcast, we will explore climate-changing effects on commercial real estate, as well as key findings from Sean's MIT Center for Real Estate Forum on Commercial Real Estate and Climate Change. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dougal.
So, Sean, what are the effects of climate change on the commercial real estate industry?
It's a big question. I would say the big picture is that climate change will impact the value of real estate. You know, it's probably the most fundamental impact. And it's going to drive increasing differentials between the valuation of properties that are well prepared for climate change and those that aren't. And the two channels for that really are the two ways that we're dealing with climate change right now. Mitigation: how do we prevent or minimize climate change? And there's adaptation: how do we adapt what we're doing to live with the climate change that's going to happen? It's already sort of baked in. When we look at mitigation, you look at, for an asset, in the way it's constructed, the way it operates, is it viable in a world in which regulations and capital are pushing people to quickly reduce and eventually eliminate carbon emissions? How much energy does the building use? What form does that energy take? Is it electricity or is it fossil fuels? What type of electricity does it consume? Is it renewable or not? Is there good data to validate all of this? So if you've got a building that can check a lot of those boxes, you're well positioned to maintain or even on a relative basis grow the value of your building. If you don't, then you're at risk. And on the adaptation side, we're seeing stronger storms, floods, droughts, wildfires, heat waves, ice storms. They're all more frequent, all more severe. And so you need to look at, is this asset relatively safe, or is it becoming more vulnerable in a world where those things are becoming more frequent? How susceptible is the geography generally and which it's located? And then the asset itself, how well is it prepared to deal with these in terms of sort of the physical aspects of that building? So to me, climate change, you know, we're dealing with it in both ways. That's the way when you see climate talks like COP27 that just happened in Egypt, you know, there's a discussion on both those tracks. And both of them are increasingly driving differential values of commercial real estate assets. We haven't seen a ton of evidence in the US about this yet. Although if we later on do touch on an MIT panel I was on recently, there's some evidence there. But if we look across to Europe, which is typically a few years ahead of North America when it comes to climate-driven trends in commercial real estate and generally, our team is definitely seeing valuations affected by the degree to which the building is prepared for forthcoming energy regulations, first of all, and the flight of capital towards buildings that can reach the levels that those regulations are demanding, which just makes sense because the building is either going to have to invest in measures to make itself compliant, or if it's, you know, cheaper to operate, if there's going to be penalties, if you can't even rent out the building, which is the case for one European country, if you don't meet their energy regulations, you're not allowed to renew the lease on a building. The buyer is naturally going to look at that and reflect it in what they're willing to pay for the building.
So is part of the reason Europe's further ahead is due to government regulations kind of forcing them to be as such?
That would be a key driver for sure. I mean, I think that even on the institutional investor side, regardless of regulation, they would be ahead of us. A lot of the large reinsurance companies, for example, are based in Europe. They've been on the vanguard of flagging climate risk as a financial risk for a long time. But when we look at the regulations that are in place in the EU, whether they're specific to commercial real estate, as the ones I was describing a moment ago are, where you're going to have to reach a certain level of energy performance in the building to avoid fines or make your building still rentable, not a stranded asset, as you know, a term that we've used for, say, oil and gas or coal on this side of the pond, but is increasingly a term that's used for commercial real estate looking forward in Europe. There are also regulations on reporting. So if you're a fund investing in real estate, you're going to be forced in coming years to report on the carbon intensity of your portfolio and a number of other metrics, which are going to give information to investors to discern whether or not your fund is well positioned to, you know, continue to generate returns in a world where we're now moving towards carbon neutrality over time.
Okay. And when you talk about carbon neutrality, how much of that is aspirational versus realistic, and what sort of time frame, given the building stock we have here, for example, in the United States?
It's definitely realistic. And that's reflected in the fact that if you're an organization that's creating a net zero target and you want to have that certified by what is now pretty much the standard body for doing that, the Science-Based Targets Initiative, or SBT, they have a reduction curve for society as a whole that matches what you might hear in the media for, you know, what we need to do to stick to 1.5 or 2 degrees of warming, which is 50% reductions in total carbon emissions by the end of this decade and down to net zero by 2050. Their view is that actually commercial real estate should be decarbonizing faster than that, actually more like 2/3 by the end of this decade, because the technology to make it happen is relatively mature and the path is well understood. If you compare it, say, to commercial aviation, we really don't have the technology to be able to make airplanes fly without burning fossil fuels. The electric airplane, you know, at the scale that we would need it and the range we would need it, doesn't exist. Biofuels are still pretty nascent in that space. So that's not going to happen for a long time. Commercial real estate, we basically know how to decarbonize a building. And the formula really comes down to, it has to be all electric and the electricity has to be zero carbon. Like those are the two sort of key aspects of the formula. That simplifies a lot of things down into, you know, two key elements. But at the end of the day, that's really what you're driving for. And we know how to do those things. We can make buildings electric today. I would say the technology cost-wise is not where most building owners would want it to be, whether you're talking about air source heat pumps, which are probably the most universally applicable technology to replace boilers and air conditioning. Ground source heat pumps, geothermal, in some cases can be used. Those are expensive, though. When it comes to the energy that goes into it, though, renewable energy, you can either get that produced on site if you have the right roof, say a logistics type property with a large flat roof, which can typically be pretty much self-sufficient or more than self-sufficient, producing their own electricity. Otherwise, you've got a contract with somebody offsite. Either the utility in the city or state where you are offers a green energy program. Usually you're going to pay more for that. Or you sign a contract with a developer to build something offsite on your behalf and sort of deliver that power to you through the grid, which is increasingly the way companies are going. Either way, we know how to do it. And the precursor to doing all that typically is you're going to reduce the amount of energy in the building as much as possible, because you don't want to put too much equipment in the building going forward. You don't want to contract for more energy than you need. And so really the first step is, let's focus on energy efficiency, and we can get a long way to go with energy efficiency. For example, HVAC systems are typically about 40% of the energy use of a commercial real estate building. And 30 or 40% of the energy being used by the HVAC system is typically wasted. Sometimes you're heating and cooling at the same time. Sometimes you're using it at hours that you don't need to be. Sometimes you've got different parts of the system set to the right parameters. So there are a lot of technologies out there that can pretty quickly, with low or no capital, find you very substantial savings on the energy of your building. If you haven't switched out the lighting, that's another one. You can put some new controls on the lighting. So there's a lot of things that you can do pretty quickly that get us on the road to 50, 60, 70% reductions by the end of the decade.
Okay. And when you talk about, let's say, a specific building, what might be a payback period for kind of on the energy side, let's say, for that kind of investment?
Right. So on the energy efficiency side, if you're looking at, say, a technology that plugs into your building management system, that's just going to run the HVAC more efficiently. In some cases, the payback is instant because it's a software as a service arrangement. You're going to pay X per month and you're going to get 2X back, you know, on your energy savings. So that's the low-hanging fruit for sure. Even on other technologies that are more of a subscription model with implementation costs, you're often looking at a year. Lighting is like a year and a half typically these days. So those are the low-hanging fruit for sure. Where we're going to have harder decisions to make is when we look, say, a decade out. Typically, if you get an audit done in your building, they're going to give you a path to get to net zero. And that path is going to start with, here are some quick payback things that you can do today without having to change out the mechanicals in your building. And then it's going to lay out a path for you that says, when things reach their natural end of life, you should replace them with X. Right. So you should replace your boiler with a heat pump, for example. When your windows need to be replaced, you should replace them with perhaps triple pane, argon filled, fiberglass flame windows, something like that. In many cases, the payback on those is very, very long at current prices. So the audits I've been seeing lately are, you've got some paybacks in the year or two range in early days. You've got some things where the payback is actually longer than the useful life of the asset on some of the more capital intensive things about the building envelope. So there's work to be done on that aspect of it. That last sort of 20 or 30% of reductions is going to be the hard part.
Well, to your point, I mean, if the institutional, you know, community is valuing those higher, then perhaps, you know, selling it quicker at a higher value because it has that could be for those maybe not on a longer term hold, there could be some value captured there.
I think that's right. Yeah. So the payback is not just in the operational cost of the building, but rather in its capital appreciation.
Okay. So you hosted an MIT Center for Real Estate webinar recently. Can you talk about some of those key findings?
Yes, that was a forum MIT put on. I was one of three panelists. The first two, one, Bill Wheaton, who's an MIT professor, a real estate economist, and the other, Kevin Fagan from Moody's, were really both focused on the adaptation piece I was talking about earlier. So what is the resilience physically of a commercial real estate asset to climate change? And how does that affect the value of the building? And the professor's take, he did a study specific to Miami real estate. As you're probably aware, Miami is one of the most vulnerable places in the world to rising sea levels. And the rising sea levels lead to more incursion of water onto land. It used to be just during storms, but now even on sunny days, sometimes Miami gets some flooding. So they were interested in looking at, hey, we're getting flooding in Miami. How is that actually affecting the rents that you can collect and then the valuations on the building? You won't be surprised to hear, I guess, from a logical perspective that yes, buildings that are in zones that are more prone to flooding are getting lower valuations than those that aren't. It's only surprising in that we actually hadn't seen that until fairly recently. I think people are more aware now that this is an issue. They're actually looking for that. There are more information sources that you can go to that'll tell you that that's the case for that building. And so it's starting to find its way into the market. Moody's, you know, it's a business whose core function is assessing risk, right? You're going to invest in the bond of a company. They tell you whether that bond is, you know, AAA investment grade or whether it's a junk bond. So now they're working on a rating system for properties and how resilient they are for natural disasters. Most of those climate-driven, earthquakes was the only one in their model that's not. And so that's going to feed into what the professor was talking about. It's another form of information that investors are going to have at their disposal to value a property and decide, you know, how does this compare to that when I'm looking at the values of two different properties? So that was, I think, informative in that we're really starting to see investors take a hard look at physical risk. We've seen so many natural disasters that have really, I think, inhabited the public consciousness finally in the last decade or so, right? Maybe Katrina in the US was where the rubber started to hit the road. That was 2008 or so. And now we're starting to see that creep into the actual financial markets as well. My talk was really about mitigation. So what's the path to net zero for buildings? A lot of what we just discussed a minute ago, and the way that regulations in the EU are starting to create discussion about stranded assets if steps aren't taken to decarbonize. So that was the sort of overall view on it. And they've got a whole series. The MIT has a center for real estate, and they've got a section of that now that Colliers is participating that's specific to climate change and its impact on CRE.
Okay. Besides Miami, what are some other markets that were discussed from a, you know, vulnerability standpoint?
Yeah, they didn't get into specific markets in that session other than Miami, because the academic study was really specific to the data that was available for Miami. Mm-hmm. But certainly when we look at what's been happening, California is one that stands out in the U.S. market. We've seen wildfires a number of times, seen the electricity grid shut down to avoid creating more wildfires. So you've got pretty significant resilience risk there, and a lot of focus on how can I make my asset continue to operate in a case where the grid goes down without raising my carbon footprint. So there's a lot of interest in energy storage, for example, in California now. Drought throughout the southwestern United States is another issue. And so we don't typically think of that as having a big impact on commercial real estate, but you do need some water to run a building and to run an operation. So southwest United States, I think going forward, is another area where we see massive in-migration into that area in the last few decades. We'll see now as the climate continues to warm, whether it takes the edge off of that. Probably the place in the world that's the least vulnerable to climate change right now from a physical standpoint is the Great Lakes area. When you look at sort of global maps, it's one where the climate's already relatively cool. You're not going to sort of go into tipping points too much. Probably ice storms are the biggest risk, and electricity outages resulting from that. But those are pretty short-term issues typically.
Right. Well, yeah, that's my theory on, 100-year investment in Chicago and close to the Great Lakes. We've got a great body of water. We're getting a little bit warmer, right, but not too warm. We've got a lot going on for us, just like you in Toronto, right?
Right.
Okay, so stepping into your role within Colliers, what is our specific path to net zero, carbon neutral kind of goal?
So we'll divide that into two sides if we can. There's our own operations, which in the nomenclature of carbon accounting is scope one and scope two. Scope one being things that you actually create the emissions directly. So if you've got a car, you're burning gas in the car, you've got the emissions coming out of your tailpipe. That's a scope one. Scope two are things where you control it, but the emissions happen somewhere else. You flip on a light switch and there's emissions coming out of a smokestack from a gas or coal plant somewhere else. That's our own operations. And then there's scope three, which is everything up and down our supply chain that we influence, which we also have to account for. Within our own operations, it's pretty straightforward. Colliers, we inhabit offices, and in some cases, we've got vehicles. We've got vehicles that go around to properties that we manage for our engineers to work on those buildings, et cetera. Engineering has some trucks. So we need to electrify our transportation over time. As those cars, again, become end of life, then that's when you look to replace those vehicles. And typically, what we see in the marketplace is a significant, say 10 to 20% total cost of ownership savings for moving to an electric vehicle versus an internal combustion engine. I think the impression is that those are more expensive because the sticker price is, but the operating cost is so much lower, both for the fuel and the maintenance, that especially for a business user who's using a lot of miles over the course of a year, you make back that sticker price pretty quickly. So that's an easy point for us. When it comes to electricity, we need to procure renewable electricity to zero out our footprint there. The piece that's a little less clear is the gas that is used to heat our space and heat the water in our offices. We don't have direct control as to whether our landlords switch out those gas boilers for electric alternatives. As we renew leases, we have the opportunity to move if we want to, but there aren't a lot of electric-only options right now. So that's, you know, we think about, again, that sort of short versus long-term timeline, that last probably 20% is going to be the hardest for us. And we're probably looking, you know, 10 plus years out to get to that. But all of that, if you look at our total footprint that we report to the science-based targets folks that I mentioned earlier, that's about 2% of our footprint. 98% of our footprint is in the buildings that we manage on behalf of building owners and occupiers. And the emissions that come out of those buildings, which is globally about 2 billion square feet in the United States, about 600 million square feet of real estate that we manage. So in that scenario, that path to net zero we discussed earlier, you've got to electrify, procure renewables, and start off by doing as much energy efficiency work as you can. These are all solutions that we need to be bringing to clients. And as Colliers globally, we've got pieces of that here and there. So in a new global role as of about 15 months ago, my job is to sort of bring together all those pieces and ensure that we've got a beginning to end clear path for a client to go from wherever they are, measure what that baseline is, and get them all the way to net zero over time. It's ultimately the client's decision, because there is investment required in some cases as to whether they're going to go ahead with it. But our responsibility is their trusted service provider is to give them a clear path and help them do it in the most economical way possible.
Yeah, and use our scale to the extent from the economical standpoint, for sure.
Absolutely.
So what gets you most excited about the future here at Colliers and then for our clients? What are you seeing that, you know, from an optimistic standpoint that we can affect positively in this world?
Yeah. I think a couple of things that get me excited. One is we talked about the heating, ventilation, air conditioning. You know, there's still low-hanging fruit out there, Dougal, that we haven't gotten to yet. And I think we can make a lot of progress quite quickly by just getting on some things that maybe haven't gotten the exposure they needed. And as a company of our scale, that we can sort of get behind some new technologies and deploy them broadly and quickly to folks. So that's exciting for me. I'm also excited about the industrial space. It's the fastest growing class of real estate, and it's the most easy to decarbonize in my view as well, because you've got a lot of flat roof space. If you're looking at a manufacturing building, you could fill up all the empty space on the roof with solar, and you might get 10 to 25% typically of the electricity load of the building. If you've got an industrial space, typically, you can produce more electricity than the building consumes. And not only is that good from an environmental standpoint, but from an economic standpoint to the building owner, you're typically going to generate that electricity significantly cheaper than buying it from the grid today. As the grid starts to get more renewables in it, you also need more flexibility from the system, because the wind blows variably, the sun shines variably. And increasingly, it's become economical to pair battery storage with that solar. So now if you're a industrial property, you've got batteries, you've got solar, you can charge those batteries at night when the electricity is usually cheap. You can send electricity back to the grid during the day when electricity is usually expensive. And so you've actually created another revenue stream for your building that you didn't have before, in addition to whatever you're getting from your tenant. And your building's more attractive to tenants, because if they've got a net zero goal of their own, which many do these days, you're now well positioned to help them get there in a turnkey kind of way.
And I mean, any idea what percentage of properties are doing things like that?
I don't know a percentage off the top of my head, but I can say, like, we look at some of the leading players in this space. Prologis is one that comes to mind immediately. And, you know, they're looking over the next few years to get to about 20% deployment on their properties, and they'll go well beyond that.
Yeah.
After that, often the limiting factor is not the physical attributes of the building. It's actually the way that electricity is priced in a given jurisdiction, and whether you're able to sell the electricity back to the grid at all, or whether you're able to sell it back, you know, at the retail price or at the wholesale price, how much they charge you to do the studies to allow you to build it in the first place. There's a lot of just logistical and regulatory stuff that comes up in building that. Otherwise, I think companies like Prologis will be going even faster than they are. That's changing in jurisdictions over time, for sure, though. But it's a limiting factor. In some places, you expect to have more solar than you do. We get a lot of solar, for example, in New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, not the sunniest places in the United States. And you don't get a whole lot, say, down in, you know, Mississippi, Tennessee, some sunnier, hotter places, even Texas. Rooftop solar doesn't really work because of the way utilities price the power that you sell back to them. You can build giant solar farms in Texas and sell very, very cheaply made electricity into the grid. And that's a very big business model today. But to put it on the roof of a property, it's actually a tiny market.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to wrap it up here. I appreciate your time and I'm excited to have you with the company and your role with the company being as important as it is. So I look forward to hearing more about the developments that come out of your group.
Thanks. Appreciate it. And thanks for having me on the call today. Great to speak with your audience and let them know they can reach out to me if they want to talk any more about this. Excited to anytime.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
All right. Dibble.
There's a bullet.